Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome. For many people, this month is one of the craziest times of the year. And in the second half of today's show, we'll be joined by musician and composer Thomas Stirner. He spent a large part of his life studying sports psychology and Eastern philosophy and poured the best of both techniques into his first book, The Practicing Mind. That became a bestseller. And today we'll talk about the follow-up to that book, Fully Engaged, which focuses on using the practicing mind in daily life, might come in helpful this month. But first, a celebration of the deep connection between food, poetry, and literature in Cooking with the Muse. My guests are Myra Kornfeld. She's a chef, educator, and the author of three previous cookbooks. I'm going to read these out to you because I just love the titles of these books. The Healthy Hedonist, The Healthy Hedonist Holidays, and The Voluptuous Vegan. She teaches in the graduate nutrition program at the Maryland University of Integrative Health and the Natural Gourmet Institute, and is head chef for MyFoodMyHealth.com. Stephen Massimila is a poet, scholar, professor, painter, and photographer. He's received numerous awards and honors, including the Grolier Poetry Prize, and his work has appeared in hundreds of publications from the AGNI Literary Magazine and Verse Daily. He teaches literature and writing at Columbia University and the New School. And they co-authored this book together. It's called Cooking with the Muse, a sumptuous gathering of seasonal recipes, culinary poetry, and literary fare. I think that just about sums it up. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. It's so nice to be on.
Thank you very much.
It's such a unique book. Yes, there are other seasonal cookbooks out, but first of all, I love the fact that it is seasonal because we know that the ingredients you're using are going to be fresh and full of natural flavor. But I also love the fact that I have to tell you, when it arrived on my desk, I do get a lot of books come across my desk, and I'm very grateful for that. We've built some great relationships with publicists and authors over the years. But this arrived on my desk, and I was like, boy, this is heavy. I opened the parcel, and I'm like, oh, my goodness, the next hour was gone because I got engrossed in the book.
Oh, that's so nice.
Thank you.
So let's tell listeners a little bit about what the book is, where the inspiration or the muse, if you will, for creating this book came from, and how you describe the book in your own words to our listeners.
So maybe we'll start with the idea for the book came from, and the book had many muses, and the word muse is in the title. And one of the muses was that we were each other's muse, because Myra was always, I like to refer to her as the culinary magician. She's always conjuring up new dishes and writing and revising new recipes and blogs and articles about food.
And Stephen is the literary wizard. He was always conjuring up new poems and writing essays and reviews about poetry and literature.
Go ahead. Yeah, so we realized that our skill sets were very complementary. And Roger Verger, the great culinary figure, said that a chef works creatively, marrying ingredients the way a poet marries words. So cooking is a lot like writing poetry.
And it actually takes a poet to cook up colorful, exciting ways to write about food. And we also realized that recipes were a lot like poems.
And in short, we realized that we could write a truly collaborative book together. And we ended up writing one that's all about the marriage of recipes and poetry and cooking and writing and the synergy between the two. And it's been very exciting.
Right. So are you two partners in life, or just did you just collaborate for this book?
Well, we are also partners in life. That's how we realized each other's skill sets.
or that we realized how well we work together.
Exactly.
Right. So
we'd always been sounding boards for each other, but this was our first truly collaborative project.
Well, that helps a lot. I was actually listening to a couple of segments that you'd done And I have to share this with listeners because it made me laugh out loud, Myra. You probably know what I'm going to say, that you once were designing jewelry and you were using a pasta maker to design the jewelry.
Exactly. So I knew that there must have been, eventually it all made sense in retrospect. In hindsight, you know, it really did.
All right. So go ahead. Sorry, Stephen.
Well, I was just going to say Myra started in fashion design and I'm also a painter, and so we have both of us are artists and brought a visual and aesthetic and brought all the senses and different arts to the project as well.
Right. So there are 150 recipes, I believe, in the book. There are over 200 really glossy photographs in here. I know you're a photographer. Did you do the photo work for this, Stephen? I didn't.
Well, we had a professional photographer do our finished food dishes, but Stephen took a lot of all the ingredient shots.
Any pictures that are in the market are of specific ingredients, and there are a number that are outdoors that capture the feel of the season. I took all of those pictures, but even that was somewhat collaborative because we often had to stage the image, and Myra would pick out the watermelon, and we figured out how to cut it open in the market and take that picture.
So, right,
and
right.
Even when the professional photographer was taking the pictures of the finished dishes, Myra had to help stage that as well. You had to get the shot before it melted or whatever.
Okay.
What the item.
So a truly, truly collaborative effort there. So the book, let's talk a little about the book, how this was put together, because you take the... You take a historical perspective on the link between literature, especially poetry, and food. You draw on material from many traditions and eras, from the ancient Greeks and Romans to the Bible, medieval to the Japanese, the great romantics. It covers a whole wealth of information in here. And each segment, you've broken it down into segments of seasons. So can we begin with autumn and just let's talk about how that came together?
Well, the book actually began, we did assemble it by season, and it's organized around when each ingredient comes into season. And autumn, for instance, we decided that the ingredient that's right on the cusp between summer and autumn is the blackberry. And
right.
In both literature and in the culinary realm, it's a great moment to capture that when one season is transitioning into the other. And so the muse of...
to start with autumn in that little moment.
Right, and that's when the muse of blackberries is at the height of her powers. And we have a poem in there by Galway Connell called Blackberry Eating, and one by Mary Oliver called August, but it could be September. And the dish, the blackberry parfait that goes with it, could be a late summer dish, could be an early autumn dish, and it really could be a breakfast or a dessert.
Or a brunch dish.
Right. So we were thinking on a poetic level as well as on a literal, practical level when we assembled it. And we moved from there, from blackberries to starters and pears, to apples, to corn, to eggplant, to squash and Halloween, and then on to a Thanksgiving feast and so on and so forth. And so every ingredient is a celebration of a tradition and a celebration of literary elements. And we sometimes wrote our own. I wrote my own poems to go with it, or we drew on traditional or really just great literary works that would pair well with that ingredient. And the recipes are organized around the ingredient and the time of year.
And then we realized that all these pieces fit together in sequences that brought out new relationships between the recipes and the poems and the essays and the photos, and it kind of worked like a multicolored jigsaw puzzle to make a whole that was, you know, greater than any of the sum of the parts. And, you know, another thing is poets and chefs are always, you know, glorifying food when it's at the height of deliciousness. So they had that in common, and that's how it really made sense for us to just move our way through the seasons. And also, the autumn chapter and the subsequent chapters, while they sort of start with ingredients, they also loosely follow a meal, in that we start with kind of starters, appetizer type dishes, and then every single chapter has a big feast or two in it, and then we always end each chapter with a whole big dessert area featuring, you know, the bounty of the season.
Right.
More desserts and drinks.
Desserts and drinks, too, yes.
right.
And you so, you also add a cook's note in here, and then a poet's note in here on most of them too. I'm wondering, when you were putting this together, did you have specific poems in mind before you started? I know you wrote some of them yourself, Stephen, but did you have particular poets in mind, or did the recipes come first? How did that work for you?
It was a very organic process.
Right,
sometimes the poem inspired the recipe, and sometimes the recipe inspired a new poem, and sometimes when we paired the two, we put the poem next to the recipe.
And sometimes after we had the two together, we realized they inspired other musings. And so that's how, as we worked on the outline, as we worked on the recipes, it took shape in this organic way. And in a way, like, every recipe was different. There's one, for instance, that seared tuna with purple potatoes and tomato sauce. I wrote the recipe, and Steve, that one has an original poem by Stephen, and we actually did them both at the same time, and I was working on the recipe, he was working on the poem, and then he changed something in his poem that I hadn't done, but I realized it would be better for the recipe. Then I changed the recipe, and that was a really interesting synergy,
right,
in that particular one.
In certain instances, it was very interactive. So there was a fish in there that I didn't think went well because with the particular poem, because the poem ended up being a celebration of how ingredients have traveled the world before they reach your plate, and we needed a fish to go with the cherry tomato and the purple potato, which comes all the way from Peru and then went to the old world, back to the new world. And we wanted a fish that traveled the world, and that turned out to be the tuna. And it really was much more delicious that way anyway.
Right.
And I wrote this long Neruda-esque poem, as Myra worked on the recipe, and the poem called Seared Tuna with Purple Tomatoes and Cherry Purple Potatoes and Cherry Tomato Sauce.
Well, I'm looking here at a photograph of the portobello mushrooms stuffed with chestnuts, apples, and wild rice. And
that's a really great dish for right now.
So delicious. Yeah, comfort food, but it's also healthy.
It's also really beautiful when it's made. So it's a really good holiday table dish for Thanksgiving, Christmas, or a dinner party.
Right, and we say in the header that it's stuffed with everything voluptuously autumnal. Rosemary flax in there. There are even shiitake mushrooms, which are the Japanese cousins
right.
of the portobello mushroom.
Right.
And chestnuts and apples. You know,
all due respect to chestnuts roasting on an open fire, we like them also stuffed into a mushroom and covered with
Right. And we start with the peeled ones. They're a little easier.
Yeah, that's a feast in itself. We need to take a quick break. So we'll continue our conversation when we come back with Myra Kornfeld and Stephen Masimila. The book is called Cooking with the Muse, a sumptuous gathering of seasonal recipes, culinary poetry, and literary fare. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
All through the year we waited through spring and fall, to hear silver bells ringing, see winter time bringing the happiest season of all—chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
It's me, your heart. High blood pressure is serious, and if you think I'm just going to keep ticking away, you're wrong. I can quit whenever I want, but I like my job. Just treat me better. Maybe we can do some exercise on occasion? After all, we're in this together.
Don't let your heart quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get yours to a healthy range before it's too late. For help keeping yours at a healthy range, text PRESSURE to 97779. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair airs live every Monday at noon. And now you can also catch the show during drive time at 6 a.m. every Friday. Hear from New York Times bestselling authors, innovative business leaders, cutting-edge health and wellness professionals, award-winning journalists, filmmakers, explorers, and adventurers. Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Mondays at noon Pacific time and Fridays at 6 a.m. right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, bringing you topics ranging from meditation to conservation, business and careers to health and wealth.
You found us. Maybe you've been guided to listen. Alternative Talk 1150.
Turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright.
And welcome back, everyone. We are talking cooking with the Muse in this segment with Chef Myra Kornfeld and poet Stephen Massimila. The book is called Cooking with the Muse, as you might guess. It's a sumptuous gathering of seasonal recipes, culinary poetry, and literary fare. And Myra's going to share one of her favorite recipes with us, and Stephen's going to read one of his favorite poems to us. But before we do that, I want to just ask, I know that you're both into real food, and you have a philosophy around that, and you say that there's frequently a bone broth bubbling on our stove, which you then freeze, so you've got it, you know, whenever you need it.
Well, actually, there's one bubbling right this minute.
That's what I can smell.
That's it. Can you smell it?
Yes.
Well, it sounds good, you know, on the day like today when it's extremely gray and wet in Seattle. So what is your, give us a heads up on your, or a high-level overview on your food philosophy.
Okay, well, you know, we're both advocates of, like you say, a real food philosophy. So, that's one that's dedicated to time-honored farming practices, which means raising animals on pasture, you know, where cows, for instance, are grass-fed, chickens get pecked in the soil. The philosophy encompasses using plenty of good quality traditional fats, from ghee to coconut oil to, you know, buttered olive oil, fats from pasture-raised animals. And then we advocate slow-cooked bone broth, and also we advocate preparing foods such as nuts and grains and legumes in a way that makes them especially digestible. That is by soaking them first and then, toasting them.
Mm-hmm.
And a farmer I like to quote when we start talking about real food traditions is his quotation, or our quoting. What we can say that he said is that cheap food makes expensive medicine, and we very strongly agree with that.
And yeah. We also have kind of like a slow food, fast food approach. For instance, if I like a lot of food where the oven will do the work or the stovetop will do the work, so it's maybe 5 minutes of preparation, but maybe 2 or 3 hours in the oven, and then you have this really wonderful dish at the end of it, but you really haven't had to, spend too much active time making it.
I love that. So I know that the book, you say in the book that many of the recipes are already gluten-free. If not, they can be easily adaptive. So yeah. They're very, the recipes suit a lot of people with dietary needs. Share one of your favorites with us, Myra, if you would, please.
Okay, well, this one recipe that I really love, it's actually in the spring chapter, but it's really good all year round. And it's the roasted Spanish monkfish with roasted broccoli rabe. And what I love about it is intense flavor. It takes 20 minutes from start to finish. You have this beautiful-looking dish that is easy enough for a weeknight, but really good for company. And, you know, it involves mixing together for a spice rub, some smoked paprika and orange zest and cumin and red pepper flakes. And then you poke a few holes in the monkfish and insert the garlic. And then it just gets tossed with olive oil. And that cooks for 20 minutes. But at the 10-minute point, you toss together some broccoli rabe and throw that in another shelf. And then they're both finished 10 minutes later. And the monkfish sits on the bed of broccoli rabe. And broccoli rabe is really good all through autumn, winter, and spring, and it's even around in the summer. And this dish just is easy and really delicious.
Yeah.
And it cooks up so quickly, and it's just
I've served it for 100 people parties before.
Yeah, that's my kind of cooking, when I can just prep it and leave it.
Exactly. You could prep it and leave in the refrigerator overnight and or all day, and then just you're ready to cook. You just time it for 20 minutes exactly, and it's juicy, succulent. It's really a very, very good company.
Right.
Here, so.
And of course, we have great fish up here in the Northwest. Pike's Place Market.
I once had an incident with a monkfish at Pike's
Market. Well, I think a lot of people had an incident with a monkfish.
Well,
you know,
say something about that.
Well, actually, I went up in Pike's Market to someone, you know, I was lured up to a monkfish, and they said, come on over here. And then the monkfish jumped out at me.
Yes. I stand there every time I go up there. I watch people, jump when that happens, and I still jump myself. I've actually never eaten monkfish. Yes, it's a regular trick down there. I've actually never eaten monkfish. I don't think. What kind of flavor does it have?
Oh, you must go and try it. It's like a lobster.
It's actually known as poor man's lobster. Although lobster was the poor person's food for a long time. And so when something becomes high-end, then you have to call something else the poor person's food.
But it has that chewy texture, that really meaty chewiness, so it really takes to roasting or braising really well. So you get that. It's very satisfying.
Okay.
It really is high-end fare. It's just not as satisfying as lobster.
Mm.
And in fact, we have, because Myra was just talking about how, and you just mentioned that you really have not had a lot of experience with monkfish. And I was mentioning how she had a scary experience with a monkfish. And a lot of people are off put by the appearance of the fish because it's famously ugly.
It is.
And fishermen have all kinds of derogatory names for it. And that's one reason why people refuse to eat it. And we have this theme throughout the book about ingredients that don't get enough respect. And I actually wrote a poem to go with this. This is not necessarily the poem I would read at length because it's very long, but it opens with these words: monkfish is the fish that fishes with the phosphorus lure wriggling on the barb of its ugly big frog fish face.
That's good.
And we're encouraging people to get past their inhibitions and to respect the foods and also the vegetables that get no respect.
Yeah, one of the monkfish of the vegetable world, I would say, is a celery root or celery act. That big, gnarly, rooty, ugly vegetable that's delicious on the inside.
And it's really a winter vegetable. So we have a section of the book that treats winter dishes, and there are a lot of root vegetables. And this is a gnarly, ugly clod of a vegetable. It would never win a beauty contest. But our argument is that it's an inner beauty queen on the inside. And could I read a poem?
That's one of both of our favorites is a poem by Stephen, actually, called Celery Act.
Well, you know, I don't really know if I have a favorite poem.
And that's one of my favorites.
There are poems in the book that go back to the very first recipe from 6,000 years ago on a Babylonian tablet, all the way up to poems that are by world-famous and Nobel Prize-winning poets of today. But I did write about 60 of the poems in the book, and this one, entitled Celeriac, which is another word for celery root, but it almost sounds like the name of a disease. And it's about how the celery root gets through the winter and how we don't respect it enough with the authors. Okay, so I'll read the poem. Celeriac, artery twisted on the outside, the torn, blood-draggled glove of a poor ogre's heart, the most pointlessly neglected vegetable. Bathe this knotted beauty, ancestor of the ancient ways of the earth. Slip the clots of dirt from the tangle of hairy tubules that fed green stalks in the rain. It labored all year to grow, got shovel cut, hardened into the clenched face of a fist, as if defying Dante with its uncried cry, hunched so long by dust-drunken bulbs in the cellar, unable to recall the sun's heat on flesh. when this black thing emerged, sky pierced in the winter market, the earth still refused to burn, having turned to stone like the white meat of this root, all its assertive, refreshing flavor hidden in a monster heart.
I love it. I had this vision of this hostess serving her guests and reading your poem before she serves it.
I've actually read it when I taught classes in the celery root before. I can never look at that vegetable again after that.
And it comes with a recipe for a celery root puree, a beautiful, delicious,
fluffy,
still pillowy mash.
Yeah.
And again, a lot of people think, you know, you have to, the only thing you could mash is potatoes, but there are so many other root vegetables and so forth that you can make beautiful, delicious,
silky mashes.
Right, mashes from, and this is a good example of that.
So, yeah. Well, I was saying during the break to you, this would make an awesome gift for anybody who likes food in general. You don't have to cook. I've got cookbooks that I've, trust me, never cooked from, but I like to have them on my shelves and look at the pictures. And for anybody who loves literature and poetry, what goes into testing the recipes, Myra?
Oh, my goodness. These, one thing we always want to make sure that the recipes work. So they are tested and tested again. And then I have I have other people test them and test them again. I watch them test them. They test them by themselves. We were big sticklers for going over all of the communication. I mean, we also tested so many people through cooking events and classes. We wanted to make absolutely sure that these recipes would be clear and easy to follow for cooks of any and all levels.
And I was right in there, although I didn't invent the recipes, I wanted to make sure that I understood everything. And so we don't want someone to have to own a restaurant or something to be a culinary celebrity to understand what the recipe is saying. And so we made sure to explain everything so that anybody could cook the dish and understand it.
I mean, it's really an exacting process. It's full of a lot of trial and error.
Right.
But, the good thing is that there's a lot of meals along the way. So.
Well, I know a lot of work went into this. As I said, 150 nutritious international recipes, over 200 full photographs, 3,000 years of literary anthology has gone into this. Original poems have gone into this. So a lot of work went into this. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with. I think this would make an awesome gift. And I can see people having theme parties. You can come to dinner. I'm cooking. You can come to dinner, but you're going to have to listen to some poetry too.
And there's also a lot of culinary history in there too.
Right. There's a lot of just fun factoids, tidbits, musings, you know.
Right, and it's all about being creative, celebratory, expressing values and feelings, and about human relationships, the relationship to the earth and to one another. And in that sense, poetry, history, literature, and cooking all go together.
Yeah, so we hope it's, you know, we think it's for people who love food, who want to be well-nourished, who love to read. So hopefully that includes just about everyone.
Well, thank you both so much.
It's a great coffee table book, too.
It is a great coffee table book. Thank you both so much for being with us today. I know listeners can find out more about the book and you and what you're up to at cookingwiththemuse.com, cookingwiththemuse.com. Myra Kornfeld and Stephen Massimiller, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And please do stay tuned. When we come back, we'll be joined by Thomas Stoner. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair airs live every Monday at noon. And now you can also catch the show during drive time at 6 a.m. every Friday. Hear from New York Times bestselling authors, innovative business leaders, cutting-edge health and wellness professionals, award-winning journalists, filmmakers, explorers, and adventurers. Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Mondays at noon Pacific time and Fridays at 6 a.m. right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working. Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Anti-Icky Poo, the product that gets the stink out, we cover the world of animals. This week, December 18th, it's Harmonic Energy and Shifting Sunday with Jude and Paul Ponton from the Whispering Dragon Center in Seattle. They'll be in the studio with their Accutonic Forks, Tibetan Bowls and Bells, Pua, Didge, and Rattles, ready to do remote sessions for you, your animal friends, your home or business. Plus, we'll be celebrating Christmas and Hanukkah with the Jingle Cats. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Talk radio for the heart and soul. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, I said at the top of the hour, this book will be very useful for many people out on the roads and in the shops right now in this crazy time of year. It's called Fully Engaged, Using the Practicing Mind in Daily Life. My guest is Thomas Stirner. He's the founder and CEO of the Practicing Mind Institute. He's the author also of The Practicing Mind, his first book, which is now in its second edition. He's an accomplished musician and composer and the founder, as I said, of the Practicing Mind Institute and speaks around the world on this topic. Thomas Stirner, welcome.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, I'd like to begin, if we can, with just a little peek at your first book, which is The Practicing Mind, because that did very well. It's now in its second edition. But I want to look at that first, because in many ways that led you to writing this second book, Fully Engaged. So give us a heads up on what The Practicing Mind, how that evolved for you, what was going on.
Well, it evolved from, it started when I was younger. I was very unfocused, like so many people. I had a lot of great ideas of things that I wanted to accomplish, and, you know, I'd pick a goal and pretty quickly burn up the initial incentive and enthusiasm and inspiration, and then find myself not very motivated, and I would drop it and look for the next thing I had to have. And there was a part of me that I think saved me from a lifetime of that, which was an observer that was watching this behavior really from the time I was very young. I noticed it. By the time I hit my late teens, I knew that I was never going to be self-empowered. I was never going to reach my goals if I didn't fix that part of my personality. I had, at that time, I had no idea how I was going to do that. But when I got into college, a friend of mine was taking a Religions of the World course. He gave me a book from one of his philosophy classes, and I read that, and it really got me interested in Zen mind and present momentness and everything, and I began to apply that to my life. Later in my 20s, I became very interested in sports psychology, which I later found was basically, they were both two sides of the same coin. But I think one of the things that was key for me being able to incubate all of this was the fact that what I was doing at that time in my life was I was a concert piano technician and a large grand rebuilder. And everything you do on a piano, you have to do at least 88 times because there's 88 notes, and usually you have to do it hundreds of times.
Right.
And I spent most of my days, many long-hour days, I was very popular and very successful at it, and I was working 7-day weeks all the time, and sometimes 65, 70-hour weeks. And most of that time, I was by myself. So I was in this solitudinal environment doing extremely repetitive work and alone with my thoughts. So I had this opportunity. You know, you could get very bored and frustrated, and I had this opportunity to use all these things that I was reading about and learning in this job, and I found out that it completely transformed not only my what I got accomplished, but my experience of how I was, what the experience of the process of accomplishing it. So that was when I had the idea to write The Practicing Mind, and it was actually self-published. It was first written in the mid-90s, and I didn't get to self-publish it until about 2006, and I couldn't have imagined the impact it would have or how successful it would be. But the and initially, after I wrote it, it was so successful, it scared me. I was really intimidated about writing another book because I could just hear the reviews like, yeah, this second book's okay, but it's not as good as the first book. So I thought, I'm just not going to write anything else on this subject. But what I didn't see coming was I was, you know, doing this consulting work on this subject and working with individuals and companies and speaking engagements and Q&A sessions. And I started seeing the same questions come up from people after they had read The Practicing Mind, and people wanting more information about specific things told through stories, which is basically how I teach. And so then I started to feel like I could write a second book based just on that information there, the stuff that people are asking for. So in some ways, you could look at Fully Engaged as another seven chapters to The Practicing Mind.
Mm-hmm. But it's also definitely a standalone book here, and put together by all these questions that you kept asking. How did writing this book change you? The first one changed you a lot, it seems. Did you have the same experience with the second one?
Yes, because I think what has changed me is, you know, now I've been in this for 11 years, and I've been working with people on a daily basis. And, you know, I work with everybody from high school athletes and even younger to, you know, senior executives. And so people are coming at me with all different scenarios saying, I read your book, how do I apply this to my life and what I'm trying to accomplish? And that really, you know, having to distill that into Fully Engaged has clarified a lot of things with me, because I have to think about, well, how do I teach this person how to use this in stock investments, and how do I teach this young athlete who's trying to figure out how to enjoy practicing, or this young musician how to enjoy practicing? I've had to apply it to a lot of different scenarios, and I've had to refer back to and remember what I wrote in The Practicing Mind, and then also think about, well, how do I say this new stuff that I'm talking about in Fully Engaged? And some of the subjects were difficult, you know, talking about learning to see, like, you know, what did I get out of the passing of my mother, you know, when she died of cancer? What positive came out of that? You know, it was difficult because in some ways it conflicted with how I was feeling, you know, at the time. You know, I didn't think there was anything good about it, you mm-hmm. know, but later on I saw that there was.
What did you say that was good?
Well, I learned a lot in her passing. One of the things, you know, my mother was just an extraordinary spirit. She was very quiet, and I dedicated the first book to her, and I said she taught so many, so much with so few words. And when she passed, we had, she was 64, she had people that she had babysat when she was 12 years old that had not seen her since then calling the house to tell us what an amazing spirit she was and how she impacted their life. She was yeah. really very unusual. And she was that way in the process of dying. She was, her concern was for the other people around her to ease their suffering from what they were going through. Her courage, her eye contact with you was amazing. And I wasn't really noticing it at the time until afterwards, you know, when I began to just think about her. And writing Fully Engaged, where I had to really sit down and think of, I think this is an important subject to cover in this book, because we all go through these things, and there is positive in all things, and I think I need to distill that. And so it was a learning process for me.
Mm. You say, without a doubt, the most important personal quality is self-awareness. You say it's the key to the prison door. Talk to us about that.
Well, self-awareness for in this context is the understanding and the knowing that I am not my thoughts. I am the one that experiences my thoughts. And some thoughts that my mind produces, I create through intention. I need to solve this problem, so I'm putting my mind to work on this problem. But most of the thoughts that our mind creates during the day, our mind creates out of the impetus that it is a problem-solving machine. That's what it's here for. That's the reason why we're talking on, we have this technology that we can have this conversation today. It's the reason we don't live in caves anymore. Our mind is always looking for a way to solve problems, to make things easier, to make things better. The problem with that is that, you know, if you don't give it a problem to solve, it will go looking for one. And it doesn't like being in the present if it doesn't perceive there's a problem there. So it's always running around. It's either regretting the past, revisiting stuff that's already happening and thinking, if I hadn't done this, if I hadn't said that, then I wouldn't be in this situation today. Or it's anticipating something that's going to happen in the future, even if it's only a few minutes into the future. It's never, it really resists being where we are right now doing what we're doing. And we don't understand that, and we don't notice it. We just basically go along with it because that's the way that we have behaved our whole life. And every time it produces a thought, there's always emotional content that goes with that thought, and so we just experience that emotional content. And as I was growing up, I was told that you can't control your emotions. They're just your emotions. And that's completely untrue. When you begin to realize and separate yourself from your thoughts, when you begin to have that skill and that tool, you begin to empower yourself, because then you can choose. You have the privilege of choice, that this thought that is my mind is producing right now is going to take me someplace that I know is going to be uncomfortable, and it's not going to serve my happiness, and it's also not going to produce the results that I want.
Right.
So I'm not going to allow that thought. That's a concept that is very foreign to us, but it is possible, and we can learn to do it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I grew up around a lot of arty, creative people, and temperament with that temperament was an excuse for bad behavior sometimes.
Absolutely.
And once you learn to control that and put it in perspective, it makes all the difference. We need to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you, talk to you about what pushes us out of the present moment, because you say it's incompleteness. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Thomas M. Stirner. His book, Fully Engaged, Using the Practicing Mind in Daily Life.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
Alternative Talk 1150.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And I'm very pleased to have Thomas Stirner on the phone with us today. He's the author of Fully Engaged and The Practicing Mind. But today we're talking about Fully Engaged and learning how to use the practicing mind in daily life. And I wanted to ask you, Tom, first of all, you use the terms awareness training and meditation interchangeably. And you say what pushes us out of the present moment, you say, is incompleteness. What do you mean by that?
Well, we all experience a feeling of incompleteness. We feel that happiness is someplace other than where we are right now and in what we're doing. It's always when we accomplish this thing, when we have this thing. It's a cycle that we participate in, I think, for the most part, unknowing. And unfortunately, it's getting worse because we are connected, we're hyper-connected in our culture today through our smartphones and our tablets and our computers and our television. So the marketing media always has access to us, and it can nurture this feeling of incompleteness, which makes us constantly feel like I'm not happy right now. I can't be happy right now because I'm watching all these people that have all these things that I don't have, and I have to get those things so that I can feel like life isn't passing me by. Now, I would say that I don't think that this I don't think this is a bad feeling. I think that we're supposed to have this feeling. We just misinterpret it. The feeling is there because it drives us to expand. Because as a human spirit, we should know and want to expand. We should want to grow and become more. And our ability to do so is infinite. And that's why no matter what we get in this world, the feeling never goes away because it's not supposed to go away. But when we misinterpret it, it makes us feel like, well, I need to stop this feeling instead of embracing the feeling and realizing that it's a blessing. That is why we have all the great art that we have. It's why we have the technology. It's why we have warm houses in the wintertime. It's all those things has come from this feeling inside that is telling us to grow and to do more and to find out all that we can be and to reach our potential. And as I said, though, it drives us out of the present moment because it always, when it's misinterpreted, because it makes us feel like where I am now is not where I want to be. I want to be out there in the future when I get this new car, you know, when I'm making $20,000 more a year, you know, whatever it is. And even though if we sit back and we look at this, we can see that when we were young is when we get this toy, when I get this prom dress, when I get my first bike. You know, it's a cycle that we just repeat and we continually participate in without taking the time to look at this and say, you know what, this is really being misinterpreted.
Mm. Let's talk about goals a little. I know that you say, you talk about this a lot. There's a video, too, that I saw where you talk about goals. And, of course, many people will be setting new goals in the new year, no doubt. And you say that we can sabotage our confidence by creating goals with inaccurate data, which I think happens a lot when we set unrealistic deadlines and, you know, things that are just unrealistic. We set ourselves up for failure. But give us your perspective on that.
Yes, I think that one of the most common mistakes we make when we set a goal is that we immediately, subconscious or otherwise, attach a time frame to it in terms of how long it should take to accomplish that goal, even though we don't really have any data to support that. And then we immediately begin to judge our progress based on where we are on that timeline. So a very good example that I've used many times for this time of year is a weight loss. And it's something that everybody can understand. If I say, I think I want to lose 20 pounds, that should take me 10 days. Well, see, when we say that, we all know that's an absurd time frame for losing 20 pounds. But if it's on a subject that we don't really know, we do the same thing. So what happens with that goal? Well, what happens is that we can say, all right, I'm going to use this nutrition program. I'm going to use this exercise program. I'm going to get this much rest. And we could be actually moving forward at an accelerated rate, but we're not going to, you know, 5 days into it, we get on the scale and we've lost 6 pounds or something, and we go, I'm terrible at this. You know, I'm almost out of time here. There's no way I'm going to hit my mark. And that means that I'm not very good at this and that I'm not capable of accomplishing this goal. And then all this negative self-talk starts, which is completely inaccurate, but it's all based on this data that we don't have, and we're not even aware that we don't have it. And I think it's important that we understand that sometimes with our goals, we can't know everything that we need to know to really set an accurate time.
Right.
And also, I think it's important to state that many times when we start to achieve goals, our perception of what we're capable of changes, and we changed our goal without even noticing it. So, for example, I once had a woman that had left the corporate world and was starting another career, and in that career, when she first started working with me, she said, I asked her what she was struggling with, and she said, well, I've been at this 6 months, and I'm not as good as I should be. And I said, well, how good should you be? And she said, you know, I don't know. I said, well, if you don't know how good you should be, how do you know you're not better than you should be for this 6 months? And she said, you know, I don't know that either. And I said, well, if you were where you are now 6 months ago, would you have felt that you were good? And she said, yeah, I would. And I said, so what's happening here is it's not that you're not improving and moving forward. It's that your understanding of how good you can be, that perception is changing. And isn't that always going to be the case? So you need to understand that so that you're not judging your progress based on how good you think you can be, because that's always going to be changing. So it's, you know, it's understanding these things when we set goals, which changes our experience of the process of achieving the goal.
Mm. Don't we get in our own way a lot? continuing that vein of thought, let's talk about struggle a little bit more. You say when I'm feeling a sense of struggle, I know something is askew and I'm not fully engaged in the process of what I'm trying to accomplish. And I often find I feel that sense of struggle or kind of frustration in a way when I'm ready to have a big breakthrough. But I have to almost feel that struggle before I get to that. Share your view on that.
Well, for me, whenever I notice that I'm feeling uncomfortable, meaning a sense of struggle, what I immediately become aware of is it's because I'm up against a threshold in my ability. I'm in the process of mastering something. Because the things that you've already mastered, you don't feel a sense of struggle with because they're easy. So when you feel that you're struggling with something, and it's that we're not just talking about learning a golf swing, we're talking about maybe it's dealing with somebody that's particularly difficult. If it's not easy for you to deal with that person, you're in the process of learning how to deal with that person, and you're gathering data. So it's quite normal to feel uncomfortable because you don't have enough information and you haven't mastered the skill of dealing with that person. And I think when you can shift like that and you can realize that, say, for example, if you're in a job interview and you're feeling this way, your lack of confidence is not from your inability to deal with the situation. It's coming from it's an indicator that you're in the process of gathering data, and it's completely normal to feel that way, and that it comes from being up a threshold, and this is an opportunity for you to execute. You can't execute and improve until you're in the situation. You can prepare and say, when I'm in the situation, I'm going to execute this way, but you can't actually execute until you're in the situation. So, you know, if you want to be good at doing job interviews, you have to be in job interviews to do them. Now, when you're outside the job interview, you can review and you can observe and you can say, this is what I think I should do better. But you can't actually execute that planning until you're in a job interview. The same thing, if you want to be comfortable singing in front of 1,000 people, you can sing in front of the mirror all you want. You can practice your vocalizing exercise, but sooner or later, you got to step out on the stage. And that's where you get the opportunity to execute. And yes, it's going to feel uncomfortable. It's quite normal for that until you get so many repetitions in to where it starts to feel comfortable and normal. And that's all part of the process. And if you can accept that and change your perspective to understand that, it not only changes your experience of that particular process, but it changes your ability to perform in the situation.
Right. That practice thing is so. I was listening to, I think it was Tony Robbins in an interview, and he looks like a very practiced, easy performer. But he said before he started all this, he spent hours and hours and hours and hours in his bedroom practicing with a hairbrush. So, you know, as his microphone.
Yeah.
So that practice thing is so, so key. Let's very quickly, we've only got a couple of minutes here, but you say multitasking does not work. You are a very busy man. You're into all kinds of things, you know, running your company, practicing Mind Institute. You are a musician, a composer, you're writing, but multitasking doesn't work. So tell us why not.
Well, multitasking doesn't work because it doesn't exist. It's now called switch tasking. And what they realize is that even things that we think we're doing at the same time, we're not. So, you know, if you think you're texting while you're emailing, you're not. What happens is that your brain has to stop and start very quickly in order for that. It just that it happens so quickly that you think that it's happening at the same time. It's very draining mentally, and it really is not very effective or efficient for improving performance. There is a test that was I learned about by a guy named Dave Crenshaw, who wrote a book some years ago called The Myth of Multitasking. And in that, he gives a simple test where you write, multitasking is worse than a lie. It could be any sentence, but when you write it, you write M, underneath of it you write 1, then you write U, underneath of it you write 2. And you do that all the way across the page with the timer running, and you time how long it takes you to get through there to write the sentence and write the number for under each letter. Then after you finish that, you set the timer again, and you just write the sentence, multitasking is worse than a lie, and you just, after when you finish that, you go underneath it, and you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way up to you finish that. And what you find when you do that is that you will, when you just write the sentence and then just write the numbers, you will be about 35 to 45% faster, depends on the particular person. But the point is that most people would think, if I say, I want you to write this sentence, multitasking is worth a lie, and I want you to write M1, U2, that they're doing one thing. But from their brain's perspective, that's
right.
Not true.
Right. Makes sense. Well, I thank you so much for being with us today, Tom. The book is called Fully Engaged, Using the Practicing Mind in Daily Life. It's a really small book, but I think really powerful. And I know listeners can find out more about you at your website, TomStirner.com. And is that the best website?
Yeah, that's a great starting point. There's the Practicing Mind Institute and the PracticingMind.com. But the TomStirner.com at least is an easy place to start.
All right. Thank you so much, Tom, for being with us. I really appreciate your time today.
Oh, thank you, Vicki. It's been a pleasure.
And again, my guest, Thomas M. Stirner, Fully Engaged, Using the Practicing Mind in Daily Life, is his book. And that's it for today. If you have questions or comments or feedback on today's show, you can find me at 800-495-7617 or info@conversationslive.net. I'm also on Twitter @VickiSt.Clair. We'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.